I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to Radio Times. After a five-year investigation, the Senate Intelligence Committee released a damning report yesterday detailing the brutal treatment of terror suspects during the Bush administration in the aftermath of September 11th. Senator Dianne Feinstein, chair of the committee, said the CIA actions described in the torture report are a stain on our values and our history. The report concluded that conditions in secret prisons were worse than what the CIA had acknowledged, that the agency misled the White House and Congress, that techniques including waterboarding and sleep deprivation did not lead to actionable intelligence, and that the interrogation and detention program was poorly managed and, quote, deeply flawed. The CIA and Republicans issued their own reports critical of this one. We begin with Jonathan Lande, senior national intelligence reporter for McClatchy Newspapers, to find out more what's in this Senate report. And Jonathan Lande, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's good to be here.
So what 5 years ago sparked this investigation by the Senate Intelligence Committee?
So this began actually as a look by under the former chairman, Senator Rockefeller from West Virginia, at the question of the destruction of videotapes of the waterboarding of Abu Zubaydah, who was the first person, suspected terrorist, to be taken in by the CIA program. And confined in a secret prison where he underwent some of these techniques before the Bush administration and the CIA had actually gone about developing the legal, quote-unquote, basis for these techniques and getting the approval or getting sort of the legal approval of the Justice Department. And that grew into the look at the destruction of these tapes grew into this larger four-year investigation that encompassed the entire so-called rendition, detention, and interrogation program that essentially lasted in practice from 2001 or 2 into 2007 and was sort of officially shut down, if you would, by the current president of the United States, Barack Obama, as soon as he took office.
Jonathan, you've been covering this issue for some time now. In fact, had sort of advance warning of some of what was in this report. But now that it's out and now that you've had a chance to read through it, is there anything that is new and shocking? I have to say, having read some of the report and about it, it is very disturbing and quite shocking.
Well, let me stress that I'm still actually working my way through this 524-page executive summary conclusions and findings that was released yesterday by the Senate Intelligence Committee. It's an executive summary of a much larger body of work, 6,700 pages or more, that we're not going to get to see. And as you pointed out, we actually managed to get a hold of what were then the classified conclusions of this report back in April. And happy to say that we were absolutely dead on in what we learned back in April. So the conclusions and the major conclusions and findings of this report was no surprise whatsoever. What is really disturbing, however, are the sort of the intricate, gritty, grisly details of what some of these detainees were put through, including 26 detainees who apparently had absolutely no business being detained by the CIA, rendered, which is another word for being abducted, and then brought to these secret sites where a number of them, I think something like 39 out of more than 119 people who were the total number of detainees, but something like, I think, 39 of them actually underwent these procedures. And just learning the gritty details is what really is where the shock value lies, I think. One of the most sort of, I think, damning parts of this report is actually an appendix which takes testimony in 2007 of the then CIA director Michael Hayden about the so-called RDI program and compares what he says with what was actually in the CIA records that the Democratic staff of the committee, let's note that the Republican staff pulled out, the Republican side actually pulled out of this report, out of this investigation, only a few weeks into it. But they went through something like 6.3 million or more pages of CIA, top secret CIA emails and reports and records and photographs. And they compare and contrast what the then CIA director Michael Hayden was saying with what they actually found in CIA records. And that is a really effective and disturbing part of the report, because virtually everything that General Hayden said the Democratic staff found to be either not true or exaggerated or non-existent.
Well, and I think we should get into some detail here. And this is, as I said, this is deeply disturbing stuff. We're talking about shackling, sleep deprivation that goes on for what appears to be days on end.
180 hours, up to 180 hours, which is just a little more over 7 days a week of sleep deprivation for some of these detainees.
Waterboarding, as we know about, I think Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was waterboarded something like 183 times.
Right.
People slammed against walls, a lot of nakedness, people put in diapers, rectal feeding. It's a breathtaking list of techniques.
Absolutely. And the bottom line being, and something that we've been reporting for some time, and actually something that the committee chairwoman Dianne Feinstein and other members of the committee have been saying, is that these techniques, at least according to this report, produced no intelligence on, you know, impending plots, produced very little intelligence that led to, or none, at least according to this report, that led to the uncovering of very senior Al-Qaeda operatives, including Osama bin Laden. And as you point out, it's you know, the gritty details associated with some of these interrogations. The fact that I'm looking at the report right now, where you had Abu Zubaydah, who was believed to be originally, you know, this very, very high level Al-Qaeda operative. Turns out that perhaps he was not. Was waterboarded so intensely that at one point it looked like they were going to lose him, and all they saw was sort of his mouth bubbles coming up through the water that was stuck in his mouth. We learn of instances where we learn, and this is something we knew before, that two detainees had died while being held in a secret prison, and one of them, the treatment of this man, who apparently was not a terrorist after all, I think his name is Gul Rahman, an Afghan, is just atrocious, and he eventually dies of suspected hypothermia, but that's not something that actually was ever proven. And so the question is, did he die as a consequence of some of these horrendous procedures that were done on him? That's a question that this report doesn't answer and that we may not ever learn.
Jonathan, I'm looking at something that you wrote, and just picking up on a couple of your findings. The agency assigned unqualified personnel to run secret overseas black site prisons, where it held in often inhuman conditions at least 119 detainees. The question about the qualifications of the personnel and even the two psychologists who apparently had almost no background or experience in interrogation, setting up this program and getting paid something like $81 million.
Indeed. And these are two psychologists who are associated with this program that U.S. troops go through called SEER training. This training is intended to help, for instance, pilots who are captured by the who are downed evade the enemy. It teaches them some of the techniques that have been used by American enemies in the past, and waterboarding is one of them. But the way the CIA described how this procedure, waterboarding, was going to take place to the Justice Department in order obtaining the legal opinions that basically allowed them to do this is just very different from what they actually did. You know, it's a very controlled procedure when American troops go through it. They just went completely overboard in terms of what they did to some of to the three people who were, we know, who were waterboarded. And that's something else that's sort of buried in this report. There's a couple of things that really jumped out at me. One, that there's a possibility that more than these three people were waterboarded. The report notes that the committee came across a photograph that was taken in a black site that the CIA says none of these so-called enhanced interrogation techniques were ever carried out, and yet the photograph shows a waterboard surrounded by buckets of water. So that raises the question about whether or not more than these three people that we know were waterboarded were actually waterboarded. And there have been persistent allegations that that happened. I think Human Rights Watch published a report which talked about allegations that waterboarding was used on other people, suspected Libyan terrorists, who apparently turned out not to be terrorists in the end. And so that's really interesting. And the other thing that jumped out at me that I put in that story was there's a note in this report that the CIA paid millions of dollars in cash to foreign officials in order to encourage their governments to agree to host some of these secret black sites or to agree to the expansion of these secret black sites. And the report doesn't call it bribery, but that's the way it sounds to me.
Well, Jonathan, about a minute, and I hate to do this with just a minute left, but the report also says that the CIA kept Congress and the White House, the Bush administration, in the dark about what was going on. At the same time, we know that Vice President Dick Cheney talked about, you know, going to the dark side. President Bush did authorize a detention program shortly after September 11th. Can we say the White House did not know about this based on this report?
I don't think so. I think that that's a real stretch. Look, the committee didn't look at the culpability or responsibility of the White House, the people in the White House, George Bush, Cheney, and others, in terms of authorizing these procedures and others. Let's not forget that some of these procedures, not waterboarding, but some of these other procedures, found their way to Guantanamo, found their way to Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. And what this report doesn't look at is how did all that come about and what were the roles played by the very senior individuals within the White House. But the fact that the CIA had this enhanced interrogation program was known in the White House. It was authorized by the President of the United States. The authorization may not have specifically mentioned these so-called EITs, but certainly the White House was following the so-called take of intelligence from these detainees very, very closely. There are something like more than 9,000 pages of documents that were withheld by the committee, by the CIA, and sent to the White House, which the White House is still sitting on.
And Jonathan,
yep.
No, I hate to do this to you. We have to end our discussion. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio
My
Times.
Pleasure.
Jonathan Lande, Senior National Intelligence Reporter for McClatchy. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Barney Moss-Cohen. We are talking about the Senate Intelligence Committee report released yesterday on the CIA's interrogation and detention program under the Bush administration. The report said that the CIA used torture against detainees, misled Congress and the White House, and did not reveal, and the program that they used did not reveal meaningful information. The CIA has taken issue with the conclusions and how the report was done, as have a number of Republicans, but not John McCain. And here he is speaking on the Senate floor yesterday.
I know from personal experience that the abuse of prisoners will produce more bad than good intelligence. I know that victims of torture will offer intentionally misleading information if they think their captors will believe it. I know they will say whatever they think their torturers want them to say if they believe it will stop their suffering. Most of all, I know the use of torture compromises that which most distinguishes us from our enemies. Our belief that all people, even captured enemies, possess basic human rights, which are protected by international conventions the United States not only joined, but for the most part authored.
Joining us now are Mark Bowden. He writes for Vanity Fair and The Atlantic, among other publications, author of several books, including most recently The Finish, The Killing of Osama bin Laden. Mark Bowden, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
Also with us is Deborah Perlstein, professor at Cardozo Law School, where her research focuses on national security law, the separation of powers. From 2003 to 2006, she served as the founding director of the Law and Security Program at Human Rights First. And Deborah Perlstein, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks very much for having me.
And Deborah, starting with you, are we talking about torture here?
Yeah, I think there's no question we're talking about torture here. And you can pick your definition. Under international law, the president has now called it torture. And anyone who reads, I think, the details of the report might be able to conceive of the details of the report, I think any fair-minded person would describe this as torture.
So if this were done to Americans, probably Americans would think of this as torture?
No question. And your previous guest described what some of this is. And one of the things that's been, one of many things that's been sort of surprising and disturbing about the report and the reaction to the report is that, some, including some in the previous administration, continue to insist, this isn't exactly torture, and I think we're past the point where the sort of semantics matter. These are techniques, and in combined form, a series of techniques that resulted in the deaths of detainees. They certainly resulted in extended suffering by these people. And I think if the shoe were on the other foot, as you pointed out, there's no question how Americans would perceive it.
How do you read this report, Mark Bowden?
Well, I think it's something that we've all anticipated, and especially those of us who have been paying attention to this issue for years were aware that the CIA and the military were guilty of excesses in questioning captives all over the world. I don't think many of the specific horrible details came as a great surprise to me. I think that it's, the publication of the document itself is political to a certain extent, as you've seen by the fact that the Republicans have reacted differently than Democrats, but that I think all in all, it's a really good thing for our country to have a better understanding of what exactly happened and why, and whether these techniques were worth the price that we're now paying for it.
And I want to pick up on that because I think that's a very important question. But I'm looking at something that came from the CIA. This is back in 1989. Quoting here, inhumane physical or psychological techniques are counterproductive because they do not produce intelligence and will probably result in false answers, kind of what Senator McCain was saying. So how do we go from that in 1989? Let me go back to you, Deborah Perlstein, to what this report says happened.
Well, that's one of the really another one of the really disturbing aspects of the report. I quite agree with Mark. A lot of the details here, or a lot of the basic facts here, the fact that detainees died in custody, were tortured, and so forth, were known certainly by people who've been following this story for years. And this report provides more detail, but the basic shape of what we did is it remains the same. What I think was surprising, were, I think, two pieces of the report that speak to your question. One was that this was not a policy that was sort of carefully crafted by interrogation experts at the CIA or experts in al-Qaeda or counterterrorism or radical Islamism in the region. This was a policy and set of practices that were crafted by people with no experience, zero experience in interrogation, no knowledge of al-Qaeda, counterterrorism, and so forth. And it was then carried out in substantial respect by junior-level CIA officers, many of whom, according to the report, had serious documented personal and professional problems, including histories of violence and records of abusive treatment of others. So this was not, you know, this was not our best and brightest. This was not a policy that came from what we knew or the history of what we had done, or indeed what it is possible to know about the elucidation of information from other people. And the other really, I think, most disturbing piece of this, new piece of this, is the extent to which, despite this, despite the fact that it came not from a thoughtful consideration of what we should do, but from fear and sort of unqualified people, despite this, the CIA has worked at the time and over a period of years to defend the program, despite really all evidence to the contrary. And it's that sort of record and continuing effort that remains one of the most disturbing aspects of this.
Well, Mark, going back to you and what you referenced earlier about whether this worked or not, and I'm just quoting from the Senate report saying the vast majority of intelligence, and this having to do with the capture and then the killing of Osama bin Laden, the report says the vast majority of the intelligence was originally acquired from sources unrelated to the CIA's detention and interrogation program, and the most accurate information acquired from a CIA detainee was provided prior to the CIA subjecting the detainee to the CIA's enhanced interrogation techniques. You have written a book about, you wrote a book about the killing of Osama bin Laden. Was there actionable intelligence?
Yeah, there was. You know, I think that the report, and this reflects, I think, some of the political nature of it, finesses the point, but in short, the reason that we were able to find Osama bin Laden is because we knew there was this fellow named Ahmad al-Kuwaiti who was one of his couriers or who was in his inner circle. And that name, Ahmad al-Kuwaiti, first came to the attention of intelligence agents back in 2001 when a fellow named Mohammed al-Slahi was picked up in Mauritania and was interrogated by the Mauritanians and by Jordan. He says he was tortured, and I believe him, but that's where that name came from. And then back in a year later, in 2002, another detainee, a fairly notorious one, one of the ones who was thought to be the 22nd hijacker, Mohammed al-Qahtani, identified Abu Ahmed al-Kuwaiti as bin Laden's courier. He also was fairly notoriously tortured. In fact, the torture of Qahtani is one of the things that led to large-scale reforms when his treatment was revealed in a Wikipedia document. The report, the Senate intelligence report, now claims that he, in fact, gave up that piece of information before he was actually tortured. My argument would be, if you're detained and you know there's an imminent possibility that you're going to be tortured, you are at that point being coerced whether or not the torturing has begun. So I think it's a bit of a stretch to claim that that information came free of the torture program. So I would argue that it wasn't as simple as, somebody under torture pointed to the place where bin Laden was living. But without a doubt, in the very complex process by which we were ultimately able to find him, torture was part of that.
Deborah, I'd be curious about your response to what Mark just said, but I mean, I guess it raises a whole host of questions whether the U.S. should torture people or not.
Well, let me respond first to what was just said and then to the broader question. So the report, which I should be clear, right, is based on this larger 6,000-page document, and the executive summary alone is 525 pages, is very clear that it is based on entirely the CIA's own records, right? So this is not some outside inquiry into what happened. This is looking at what the CIA was saying in its emails and so forth in real time was going on and where it got its information and in cables back and forth. And the question has been, did anybody who was tortured in CIA custody provide information about that led us to finding bin Laden? And the answer to that question is no. Nobody who was tortured in CIA custody provided that information, and nothing Mark just said refutes that either. So I think that's the short answer to the question. The notion that, you know, you're under threat of torture and may be in a coercive situation even if the torture hasn't happened is absolutely true. And that's something we need to take account of and need to think about. But it's yet another one of the reasons why actually torturing people is simply a sort of useless way of gleaning information. And the report is most powerful in its sections where it goes through point by point in enormous detail, citing to all of the CIA's own records about exactly how it knew or how it came to know about al-Kuwaiti, the courier, and what they learned from their own detainees and at what circumstance. So that's just in response to that question. You know, the broader point, I think, is really important. And there's been a lot of focus since the report came out and before that on was this effective, was it not effective. And I think the report is really as dispositive as anything I've seen in demonstrating there's no evidence that it was effective, and quite the contrary. But that really, in fundamental ways, is the wrong question to be asking. The question to be asking is there ever a reason to torture people? Mm-hmm. Should we torture people? And well before you get to the question of effectiveness, I'm sure it was quite effective for Tony Soprano to twist people's arms violently in order to get what he wanted. But there are a host of reasons why we shouldn't be doing this, all apart from its effectiveness, beginning with it's illegal. And it's illegal under our own laws and under international laws. And there is a reason that bipartisan legislatures and presidents and courts have concluded that it's illegal over, you know, a long period of our history. And the reason is it's wrong. And that's an element of the debate that I think importantly gets lost in the question of effectiveness, which, you know, matters as well, but is really a secondary piece of the argument.
Let me toss this back to you, Mark, and actually add an email from Terry. He says, isn't it true that we actually executed Japanese after World War II for waterboarding American prisoners, I think in the Philippines, he says, on the grounds that it's torture and a war crime?
Yeah, I think that is true, but I also think it's true that prisoners have been mistreated and tortured and killed by American forces and by our enemies throughout history. In fact, I think that the sort of large popular outcry against the treatment of prisoners is a very welcome but a fairly modern development. I think in the past, the military and intelligence agencies regarded the practices against prisoners as something to which they turned a blind eye. And I'm glad to see that that's no longer the case. I want to say that I completely agree also with Deborah that this is first and foremost a moral question. We need to ask ourselves as a country, are we willing to torture people under certain circumstances? And that becomes a moral question precisely because torture can work under certain instances. So if you are in a position of being able to potentially thwart a tragic crime or a terrible attack, and you have very little time, and you have to make, I think, a very difficult moral choice at that point. If we know for a fact that you can never get useful information from someone by torturing them, well, then it's not even a moral question anymore. Mm-hmm. Then, of course, you wouldn't do it. But I think, in fact, sometimes you do, and therefore it is a moral question.
Well, it sounds like what you're saying, Mark Bowden, is that it's immoral to do it, but we should reserve the right to do it under certain circumstances.
And I would stress that these are very rare circumstances, but they are nevertheless real. And I've written of specific instances where, to be honest, I myself would have tortured someone. Mm. But I think that if I were to make that choice, I ought to be susceptible to prosecution, that I need to have broken the law at that point. Because as soon as you legalize the use of these methods in any way, and this is exactly what we saw during the Bush administration, you inevitably invite widespread abuse and excess.
Well, let me pick up on that and go back to Deborah Pearlstein, because as my understanding, the only person who is in prison because of waterboarding is a whistleblower, a guy named John Kiriku. I probably mispronounced his last name. He went on television to talk about this program, and now he's in prison because he revealed intelligence information about this specific operation. If what we're talking about is illegal, who should be held accountable?
Right. So there's no question that it's illegal. And there is only one, in addition to John Kiriku, there is one contractor to the CIA, a man named John Pizarro, who was prosecuted criminally a number of years ago for his role in the death of a detainee in U.S. custody in Afghanistan. So there's been a single prosecution. That's not of anybody who is an employee of the CIA, but a contractor to the CIA. But that's been it as far as the CIA is concerned. And the report makes clear very senior leadership in the CIA, including the director, concluded that it was inappropriate to even take administrative disciplinary action against any of the employees the agents who far exceeded the authority that they were given, even by the administration, to carry out these techniques, because, you know, things are tough and mistakes happen, and, you know, in fact, some of the people were rewarded following some of these incidents rather than even subject to administrative discipline. So there is a huge gap in accountability.
You know what? Hold on to that thought, only because we're up on a short break here, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking today on Radio Times what a lot of people are talking about, the Senate Intelligence Committee report released yesterday, highly critical of the CIA's interrogation and detention program under the Bush administration. Deborah Pearlstein, professor at Cardozo Law School, and Mark Bowden, a writer for Vanity Fair, The Atlantic, has written a number of books as well, our guests. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Any questions or comments about this report? We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. We're talking about the Senate Intelligence Committee report released yesterday. And again, our guests are Deborah Pearlstein. She's a professor at Cardozo Law School. From 2003 to 2006, she served as the founding director of the Law and Security Program at Human Rights First. Mark Bowden writes for Vanity Fair, The Atlantic, and other publications. His most recent book called The Finish, The Killing of Osama Bin Laden. We have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. And again, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Deborah, you wanted to say something. Go ahead.
I was just on the question of accountability. There has been remarkably little of it for any of these activities. And the question is, what's to be done now? The Obama Department of Justice conducted an investigation into some of what's described in the report and concluded there was insufficient evidence to successfully prosecute some of these people. That may well be the case, right? In many instances, key evidence has been lost, destroyed, and so forth. These days, under domestic law, there are statutes of limitations with prosecutions with respect to some of these crimes. And maybe more important, you know, questions of prosecutions have focused on relatively low-level individuals who, without question, are legally culpable for what happened, but don't address the broader issues, the fact that it was senior leadership and management-level folks who, having understood and been told about how this program was being carried out, allowed it and encouraged it to continue. And the question whether it is possible to get sort of politically credible, unbiased prosecutions of the people who I think are more importantly responsible, I think is a really difficult question. So a lot of people who study these issues in the legal community and the human rights community have recommended not prosecutions, which may be difficult, but truth commissions of various kinds, other forms of reparations that may acknowledge U.S. Accountability and culpability, but be ultimately more effective than criminal prosecution.
I wonder, Mark, and I'm thinking about the church hearings and other hearings about CIA operations in times past. We're talking about an agency that largely works in secret. We're talking black budgets. We're talking about black sites. Is that a kind of recipe for the kind of excesses and abuses that are detailed in this report?
It can be, but I think in this case, the CIA and the Bush administration had overwhelming popular and political support for the steps that they took, including these steps which we are now recoiling from as having been overstepping the law and morally questionable. The truth is that back in 2001, after the attacks in New York and Washington, the country was frightened. Our political leadership was frightened. They overreacted. I think everyone agrees that the invasion of Iraq is probably the biggest example of an overreaction. But this torture program is yet another example of it. But the climate was such that there was very little political opposition to these things. And so now the notion that we are as a country somehow going to pillory those who we elected to do what, in fact, at the time most Americans wanted done is highly questionable. So I think something more along the lines of what Deborah is talking about. Yesterday I read an op-ed by the head of the ACLU recommending that the president pardon those who were involved, because clearly those who are most culpable, in my opinion, are those who were in the highest political offices in the country, because they were doing what they felt they needed to do, but also what they felt they had the support to do.
Are you talking about the president, the vice president?
The president, the vice president, the head of the CIA, the chairman of various committees in Congress. A lot of people who are wringing their hands over the tactics employed were voting for them 15, 16 years ago.
And this is not to excuse that, but one of the critics or criticisms in this report is that the CIA was essentially lying to members of Congress. Are you saying not so fast?
Well, I do think that there are instances where people testifying before Congress weren't completely forthcoming. I think that I can remember certain examples of it. But to say that somehow the Congress was completely unaware of the existence of these programs, I mean, I was writing about them and many other people were, or that they misunderstood the character of what was going on, I think would be just be wrong.
Mm. Let me put something to you, Deborah, then we'll get to our callers. And this is the two psychologists who created the interrogation program and apparently had no background in this at all, and at one point were paid something like $81 million for continuing this program. And to be perfectly honest with you, I just find that astounding.
It is. It is indeed. Now, their involvement and the fact that they were hired by the CIA and so forth is something, again, that was known before this report came out. I'm not sure the number, $81 million, was known, but it was clear they were paid a great deal of money, and it was clear that they were manifestly unqualified for the work that they were doing. But I think it goes to the larger point, which is, you know, this was able to happen in an environment of utter secrecy, and where, as it turns out, what checks we thought we had, checks of congressional oversight, checks of, you know, provided by laws that made criminal many of these activities, the CIA's own inspector general, who was, it's clear from the report, thwarted by many of those who participated in the program and trying to carry out his own internal investigations, all of these checks, for various reasons, failed to stop this program, to stop, you know, the killing of what turned out to be essentially innocent people by our own government, which is a horrifying thing to even say and contemplate. So the question is, what checks can we put in place that will be more effective next time? And the ability of the CIA to operate in total secrecy, the ability of the CIA to be overseen by, you know, a handful of members of Congress who for a variety of reasons, including they have other jobs to do, right, are probably incapable institutionally of giving the effective oversight they need to, really needs to be looked at closely. And I think of the legal actions and changes we need to take, reconsidering what checks are in place and how we can better supervise the activities of the CIA has to be a necessary consequence of the report, just like it was a necessary consequence of the revelations of CIA wrongdoing back in the 1960s and 70s.
Let me get Henry from, looks like Fleetwood, Pennsylvania, to join us. Henry, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. No, we don't seem to have Henry.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Go ahead, Henry.
Oh, hi. I'm sorry. I thought I was going to listen for a recording of my voice. I have 2 points. Number one, the timing of this, we all know that this went on. Releasing the actual report is going to create a lot of activity, most of it negative, against the United States. It's also going to create a situation where other nations who have been our allies up to this point are going to say, we can no longer trust you when you tell us you're not going to reveal something, anything about secrets between our two nations, because obviously somebody in your administration is going to say, oh, no, the public needs to know. I don't think the public has a right to know about agreements between the United States and other nations. Those things.
Well, but Henry, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about what the CIA did to detainees that were held in secret sites.
I understand, and the fact that they went to a half a dozen lawyers or whatever, and the lawyers all said it was legal. I'm not saying it is legal, but they went through, at least supposedly, all the steps that were required to say we are allowed to do this due to the circumstances that brought this on, as in 9/11.
Let me take your point, and that's sort of what you were saying, Mark Bowden. Anything you want to say back to Henry?
I think that there's always a danger when you're doing business with a democracy that somebody's going to leak information or the press is going to find out about it. That's one of the downsides of a democracy. If you want to deal with a country that can keep a tight control over everything, you're probably better off dealing with Kim Jong-un.
Mm, living in a different country.
Yeah, I mean, it's just the nature of our system, and I'm glad I live under it, but it does present certain certain problems, and among them are, maintaining coherent relationships and with intelligence agencies around the world.
I wonder, too, Deborah, and this is something that the president did, President Obama did shortly after he took office in 2009. He issued an executive order banning torture. Executive orders, of course, can be changed when the next president comes in. Do you think there are things that can be done to codify that?
One of the things that's most disturbing and leads me to the conclusion that the checks we have are insufficient is there are a host of laws already on the books, not just in the form of executive orders, which it's quite right can be withdrawn by the next administration, but in the form of congressional statutes and treaties that the United States signed and ratified, and as Senator McCain said, substantially drafted, that all prohibit exactly this activity. It's for that reason that many people think the failure to prosecute is more important than the existence of laws on the books. In other words, we have a lot of law that says you can't do this. Mm. The question is, what are the consequences that people face when they violate those laws? And that's what makes the question of accountability so important. If I could, I want to just respond briefly to the caller's
sure.
point and be clear. It's not the release of the report that is what may lead to instances of violence against the United States overseas and criticisms by our allies and foreign agency liaisons. It is the practices that the United States carried out that is reflected and revealed in the report that, as the caller himself notes, were already really known by our enemies and our allies before the report itself came out. And in fact, the report is quite vigorous in documenting how many of our allies having agreed to host these black sites and participate with U.S. and the United States in counterterrorism activities, began to balk when they realized what the United States was actually doing back in 2005, 2006, and so forth. And it was for that reason, finally, that the CIA itself concluded, gee, we really better stop this. We're losing some of our most important weapons in the counterterrorism fight. And it's the practice itself, not the reporting or revelation of the practice, which again, you know, had already produced these negative consequences that we need to focus on.
Let me get Dorsey from Newcastle, Delaware, to join us on Radio Times. Dorsey, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Something that hasn't been brought up, I think perhaps Deborah did a little bit while I was calling, but I didn't hear it all. But in general, that hasn't been brought up with a lot of conversations in the last few days, is that the people who carried out this torture are sadists. I mean, can you imagine doing this to somebody? It's very frightening. It's not something that I think a patriot would do because it would help. It's something that I think most of these people must have enjoyed doing. Well, because otherwise it's so horrible that they couldn't do it. And I did hear a description of one person who had been constantly tortured, and to the point where he was like Pavlov's dog. He would go and lie down in the space that he, without being told, to be waterboarded, and he would put his arms in the right way, because he was just, his mind had virtually gone.
Well, Dorsey, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. I'm going to toss that to you, Mark Bowden. I don't know if they're sadists or not, but I know one description of a place in Afghanistan described as a dungeon.
Well, there's no question that when you legitimize the use of coercive methods, no matter how supposedly lenient, you invite sadists into the picture. And there is, I think it'd be nice if we could divide the world neatly into categories, and that there are those of us who are not sadists and then those of us who are sadists. So the truth is that this is a piece of human behavior. And I think that if you are put in that environment and given that authority over another person and given the rationale to apply, to inflict pain and tremendous discomfort, it would tend to bring out whatever inclination you might have, even deeply hidden, to behave sadistically. That's, that is the big reason why it's always a mistake, and this is the mistake that the Bush administration made, to try to legalize or legitimize the use of these methods. My point is, I think, that even though sometimes the urge or even the need to do so is compelling, but it has to be breaking the law when you do it.
Final word from you, Deborah, before we have to say goodbye.
I guess it's really hard to know, and I'm still reading through the report as well, how to characterize what's most important here. There's a lot that's important. But I do want to, I guess, just close by pushing back briefly on the last caller. Yes, it's possible that some of the people who carried out some of these acts were sadists or criminals. It's also the case, I think, that a lot of them at different levels from top to bottom thought they were acting with the right kinds of motivation. And it's for that reason, right, you have to keep these things illegal, prosecute those who actually are sadists and those who violate the law even for the best motives. But that's why leadership is required. That's why even in an environment of fear and chaos and so forth, when people are liable to do the worst kinds of things, you need a clear head and attention to the legal commitments we've made based on the moral assessment of who we are, to step in and say, you know what, we're not going to do that. And it was the absence of that and the failure of that over a period of years that I think should maybe trouble us most.
Well, my thanks to both of you, Deborah Pearlstein and Mark Bowden. Thanks for joining us today in Radio Times, giving us much to talk about and think about.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're very welcome. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program and carry on a conversation on our Facebook page. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.